From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. Welcome back to Season 2 of Migratory Patterns, and a special thank you to everyone who's been finding us over the last 6 weeks since we've been off. We really appreciate having you here. We've got a bunch of really great guests scheduled to come on. I think you're really going to enjoy our conversations. We raise a lot of new issues, new topics. People have challenged some of my preconceived notions, and they made me think a lot. I'm really excited to start sharing these conversations with you, so let's get started. We're kicking off Season 2 with two special episodes. I'm going to be talking to two of my oldest friends, one of whom you've heard mentioned on the podcast before. He's the one I usually refer to as one of my best friends from college who now lives in Hong Kong. More from him next week, but this week we're starting off with a twist. I'm interviewed by one of my other best friends from college, Virginia Johnson. On a trip back to my hometown of Boston in December for her wedding, Virginia and I sat down to talk about what life overseas is like for me. I've known her since she started college, and we've been close friends for over 20 years. My wife even calls her my sister friend, which we both love. In our discussion, we explore how I feel about my migration story through the questions of a loved one who has been left behind. What was it like to make the move? What does it feel like when you come back for a visit? And what can't you talk about because you don't know how to? It was a much more challenging conversation than I thought it would be. There are a lot of interesting things that happened to me on this last trip back to my hometown. Some things that we only touch on in this interview that'll come up in future conversations. Things like, how does it feel to be back, but in a sense, can you ever go back? How does it feel to be in a place that you know you came from and you love, but you don't feel like you can be in again? It's really complicated, and I'm still kind of dealing with it. One of the things that I've loved about doing this podcast and all these conversations is that I'm learning so much with each talk. I hope you're following along and learning too. As I've said, there's a lot of cool conversations coming up, and we're going to be working through a lot of issues together. But for right now, just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Virginia Johnson.
Mike Shaw, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Thank you.
Where is home?
Home is Beijing physically, and as I've been learning over the past year doing these podcasts, it is also a complex mishmash of things happening inside my heart and inside my head. So I think I will always have this super incredibly strong Bostonian, New Englander, American identity in that order. And one of the things I've noticed is that whenever I come back to the U.S., comes out even more. So I think we were eating earlier and I said, when we went out shopping today, my inner masshole came out. And you were like, what, is there an outer? Like, is some other level I don't
What's
know?
What's the inner?
Yeah. It's not repressed so much where living overseas, but there's so few outlets for expression and there's so few affirmative there's so few affirmations of it that get reflected back at me. So it's almost like you're kind of in a room. Imagine you're in like a room yelling for someone to hear you and you don't get any echoes back. But then when you're here, you just see it everywhere. Like, oh my God. And I said this to Elisa today. I'm in a place where everyone dresses like I do.
Right.
Yeah.
So Boston is my home and where we met over 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And you're back to visit for my wedding.
Yes. Congratulations.
On New Year's Eve. Thank you. So honored and happy that you're here for this special occasion. Tell me how you feel to be back in Boston.
I feel when I come back to Boston, it's like this euphoric kind of thing. Like when I'm in the plane, like I'm jumping up and down in my seat and I'm so excited. And then there's this weird thing that happens when I'm walking around where I'm overjoyed and thrilled. Like today on the subway, we took the train. We came out to Cambridge to have dinner with you, and we went over the Longfellow Bridge, which is this beautiful old 19th century bridge that crosses the Charles River that separates Boston from Cambridge. And it's very iconic, and it's this beautiful vista of the entire city skyline, or most of it. And it was at sunset, and I actually got teary-eyed. I was welling up. So that happens on the first day or two. And then, inevitably, you start walking around corners where there are buildings that weren't there before. And I've been gone for over 10 years. So there's whole neighborhoods that are being refashioned. There is a cultural identity that is shifting in this city. And I don't have a problem with change per se, but this is my home. At least it's where it's my origin and always will be. But the thing that birthed me is no longer that thing anymore. And I, when you see those changes all around, it's not bad, it's not painful, it's just very off-putting. Like, there comes a point where I've been in town for, if I've been in town for 4 or 5 days, I kind of don't want to be here anymore. Like, there's a limit to how long I can stay. And it's, I certainly don't feel like I could live here. No, nowhere in the near future anyway. I can't imagine a scenario of me coming back and living here. I think my horizons have been broadened too much, and I don't know. It's just too different. It's the same city, but it's not the same city at the same time.
So if you're speaking to someone that still lives here, has always lived here, maybe has never been to China or even another country, what are the things that have changed the most about Boston and the things that have stayed the same the most about Boston?
So I would say, well, the most superficial thing is to say the sports culture, because that's the easiest way to express your, you know, cultural identity, your American regional identity. And that's how I literally wear it on my sleeve. If people in Beijing know I'm the guy in the Boston stuff all the time. And when I'm back here, I buy tons of Boston stuff and I wear it. It's obnoxious. I would say that's the same, if not more so. And Boston is kind of famous also for having this winning sports culture in the past 15 years, 20 years almost. And the sports culture is strong, but it's also, even that's different, because when I grew up, sports culture besides the Celtics was one of teams that can't win. Something bad's always going to happen. Your team always sucks. It's just awful. And you are a suffering fan. Now the fans here are so privileged and it's obnoxious. Right. But, you know, that's the superficial thing. The stuff that's most noticeable though is the nightlife culture is different. There's this whole different type of people that live here. Industry is different. You know, the tech sector, the biotech, I mean, that has completely radically changed neighborhoods that I grew up in. Now, I was here, I left Boston in 2008, so I was here for the beginning of it, but it has completely just changed the face of the city.
Mm-hmm. The skyline, the people who live here. So when you're in Beijing and you describe Boston to someone in Beijing who's never been here, how do you describe it?
It's, wow, to be honest, I haven't really thought of that. I'm not sure. Boston has a reputation in China. So my experience in China is that everyone knows Harvard and MIT. Everyone knows all the universities. So people don't usually ask me what Boston's like. Actually, that's not something expats ask each other. You're making me think about something here. Like, I don't, when my friend told me she was from Strasbourg, I didn't ask what Strasbourg was like. I think that's a really interesting question for someone who is still in a place to ask someone who's left that place. What do people think about our place? I don't think we think about it that way. By us, I mean people who live overseas. I think we're all really hyper-focused on the fact that we're living in a place that's not our own, that there maybe isn't an interest or even the mental capacity to start wondering what it's like for someone else. Like, what'll happen is, I think when you get to know someone and your friends, like, I have a friend who's from Morocco and he'll talk sometimes about what it's like back home. And he actually has a restaurant and a bar and he makes a lot of cool dishes and he loves to mix in the Moroccan cuisine, and he'll describe the cuisine and some of the culture and tradition behind it. And he'll talk maybe a little bit about what it was like to grow up and eat it. And I guess you learn about someone's place through those experiences. No one really sits down and asks, what's your home like?
It's the stories you tell about the sports culture, the neighborhoods, the restaurants. Maybe that is what tells the story of how you describe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you feel your horizons have been broadened from, you know, being in Beijing for 10 years. What do you mean by that? I think I know what you mean, but what do you mean by that?
Well, I think by horizons being broadened, I mean that I guess I just see other possibilities. And when you live in one place, And this isn't a value judgment. I think if you live in one place and your life is in one place, you get, I mean, this actually happens to me even in Beijing. Like when, you know, Elisa first arrived, all I could think about was my life in Beijing. This is where I am. So I knew that if she didn't like Beijing when she arrived, we might have to move. I really couldn't conceptualize moving because even though I'd moved once before, it was really hard for me to imagine being in another place. All of my options, all of my connections, all of my support system, my network, everything is in Beijing, right? So I've had a little time to reflect and we've discussed possibility of moving somewhere else. And now I understand, like it took some inner reflection for me. And maybe this doesn't work for a lot of people. Maybe it works differently for a lot of people who move overseas and I'm just slow on the uptake. But for me, I think about where I am, my life is here, and it's hard for me to imagine some other place. But now I kind of understand, oh, I moved once. I figured out how to create a support system. I figured out how to create a network. And I understand that there are other people trying to do the same thing. I can do this again.
That also speaks to me, how long you have been there and integrated yourself. I mean, when you first moved, I felt this may be just an experiment, that you might be back in Boston in a year. You might have thought that too. I don't know. I don't think anyone knew that it was going to be a 10-year, a lifetime journey. So what were some of the things that were stumbling blocks at first that you had to overcome? I mean, there had to be some tough moments.
There were. There were some tough moments in the beginning. I think I remember being really scared that I didn't know how to buy things in stores. I was actually very lucky. My first place that I moved into was a full service apartment that actually a lot of foreigners lived into. It served as the German media headquarters during the Olympics. So I lived in a building with tons of German media and they had a beer garden, an impromptu beer garden that they just created in front of our building every night. And they would just come home and there's like 50 German media people drinking beer all night. But they took care of paying all your utilities. You literally just went down to the office and the person spoke English and you handed over all the money that you needed to pay for electricity and water and gas, which was not a lot. And that was it. I mean, I didn't have to figure out the logistics of navigating the basics of life, except for like buying food. And I remember being really freaked out being down in the convenience store that I didn't know how to buy this. I didn't know how to read it. There were no apps that I could use to translate labels. I didn't know what anything was. I had to literally buy things, open them, and see if they were edible. Just trial and error. And I also learned language really quickly that way. Not enough to be fluent or anything, but to at least get around and order food and buy beer, you know? Those are like the most important things.
So when you left Boston, you were not a vegan.
No.
You became a vegan while you were living in Beijing. How did that happen?
So I had, you may remember, I was dating someone and we had a very long extended breakup, lasted like 9 months. And then it took me about 9 months to recover from that after it finally ended. And then during that 9 months, I drank quite a bit, drank a lot. I ate like garbage. I mean, I have the kind of a personal rule, don't drink on school nights. I was drinking every school night. Well, I was drinking like 3 times a week during the week. It was not just weekends. I was going to one of my friend's bars and I was at the point where I was calculating how many martinis can I have tonight and not wake up with a headache tomorrow. I was probably a functional alcoholic at that point, or at least borderline. And I realized, you know, I got to stop this. And I was also feeling really unhealthy. I wasn't going out dancing. I wasn't really getting a lot of exercise. So I realized I need to get a whole handle on my health. So I decided that I'm going to go vegetarian. Also, at that time, there was a friend of mine who, she's Russian, and the Russian Orthodox people go through, for Lent, they'll do what they call fasting. They'll have a fast, and they will give up a whole bunch of stuff. So like, you know, growing up Catholic in America, you know, we would have no meat on Fridays during Lent. They will do, for the whole 6 weeks, they'll do like no meat, no egg, or no sugar, no alcohol. There's some variations, but basically they go on maybe almost a biblical diet. I mean, there's a lot of no meat, no dairy. So we would have fun because I grew up in the 80s, you know, Cold War kid. And I'd be like, anything you stinking Russians can do, I can do, you know, this playful back and forth. And she kind of challenged me. She's like, oh, can you do this fast? Like, could you give up alcohol and meat for 6 weeks? I was like, yeah, I'll do it. So I did it. And, you know, kind of on a lark. And I realized after the first couple of weeks, this is not so hard. Mm. I gave up red meat and dairy really easily. Gave off the booze because I wanted to stop anyway. And then really only kind of had fish. I didn't have chicken, didn't have any of that stuff. So I realized after a couple of few weeks, I can do this. And around that same time, I met this woman from New Zealand, and she, in China and New Zealand have signed a free trade agreement. And she came over as kind of a follow-up to that agreement as part of this deal where China bought 250,000 dairy cattle because they want to build up their dairy industry. And she's a consultant. And she came over and she was visiting dairy farms. And she said, I met her at this event and she knew some friends of mine. And she described, well, she didn't describe anything. She said, after my first day on a dairy farm in China, I swore off meat in China. She says, do not ever eat meat in China. And everyone would ask her, like, why? And she said, I will not describe it. You can never imagine. Just do not ever eat meat in China. So that at the same time as I'm thinking about my health and I have that playful challenge with my Russian friend, I decided I'm going to be vegetarian now. So I said, I'll be vegetarian. But first, I'm going to take this trip to the U.S. where I'm going to go and eat all the things that I miss. I hadn't been to the U.S. at that point in 4 years, and it was I thought it'd kind of be like a goodbye, not a goodbye. Actually, I met you on that trip because I asked a bunch of people to come together for like an afternoon
at the Beantown Pub.
We went at the Beantown Pub, yeah. And because I didn't know if I'd be coming back anytime soon, because I realized I didn't miss it at all. Like you were saying earlier, you thought maybe it would be kind of a short-term thing or an experiment, and it
by
wasn't.
By that time, I didn't think so, because then it had been a few years. But when you first left, I thought, 6 months, a year or two, we'll see.
Well, you know, maybe, I think I knew I would live overseas, but I never thought of it so much as never being able to go back to Boston. I think by then, I knew I didn't want to go back to Boston. I wasn't missing it at all. I realized I don't miss living there. I wish I could go back like 2 weekends a year. Like I wish I could go back for like Patriots Day weekend, Marathon Monday. And I wish I could go back for like a weekend in October to go apple picking and watch baseball playoffs and the football game. But other than that, I really have no desire to be back here. And at that time, I thought I would never want to go back to the U.S. I had no desire and came back for that trip. While I was here, my very good friend, Elisa, who is now my wife, she saw on social media that I was posting from the U.S. and she said, hey, I see you're there. Do you want to get together? And, you know, I'm coming back from where I'm living in New Zealand and maybe we can hang out and see where we're at. And I said, no, I'm living in Beijing. You'd have to come there. So she decided to come to Beijing. We gave it a shot. But before she got to Beijing, we were having discussions and, you know, she's vegan and she said the house would have to be vegan. And I said, oh, that's not a problem. I don't cook at home anyway. I'm vegetarian. There's no meat in the house. So there's no eggs, there's no dairy, there's nothing. I think I had a can of refried beans that weren't vegetarian. So I think that's the only thing I had in the house that wasn't vegan at that point. My roommate at the time actually was Indian and he only cooked vegetarian at home. So there was nothing really at home that wasn't vegan. And through our further conversations, she said something to the effect of, you know, I'd have a real problem if I was with someone and we went out to eat and they were eating parts of dead animals on their plate. And I was like, oh my God, that's freaky. But I was like, okay. I was like, no problem. I could totally do that whenever we're together. I'll just be totally vegan. And then if I'm with my friends and I'm having a pizza, no big deal, right? No one has to know, whatever. But then I thought to myself, well, why would I do that? Like if I'm doing this for my health anyways, and I was learning about how what you eat affects the environment, I said, you know, screw it. I'll just be vegan. Like if I want to put my money where my mouth is, I'll just fucking do it. I did it. So I turned vegan. And I'm happy.
We are. Yeah. And this evening we went to one of the only vegan restaurants in Boston. So what's it like when you come back?
It's really hard
to eat here as a vegan.
In America, it's crazy. So it's easier in Asia to be vegan at a typical like any restaurant, random restaurant you go into, because so much of the cuisine in China and across a lot of Asia is based on vegetables. So the Chinese have a 5,000-year-old culture and meat has only been affordable to people for the last generation. So most of the cuisine is vegetable cuisine and they've kind of added meat to stuff You know, there are some meat dishes from some cultures, but most of the cuisine is vegetable-based. So any random restaurant will have tons of vegan options, just vegan by default. It's the exact opposite here in the United States. The typical restaurant will have nothing except maybe a leafy crap salad and French fries. And even the French fries might not be vegan. It's crazy. So it's kind of frustrating when you come back to America, because as an American, you're very entitled. I want what I want, and I can't get what I want, and it pisses me off.
So let's stay on that, I guess. That's a frustration coming back. What are your greatest frustrations when you come back to the U.S., Boston or any other city, in terms of comparing where the U.S. is to where China is in commerce, in things that are available in just daily life? What are your frustrations when you come back here?
God, we could do hours on that. I will say car culture. There's car culture in China, and there's crazy traffic, but the car culture in America, let me put it this way. There's car culture in China, but there is also a recognized need for mass transit and bicycle lanes. So when they've built out their infrastructure, they've built out their infrastructure. Like, they build it out for cars, they build it out for trains, they build it out for high-speed trains, they build it out for buses, they build it for bikes. Like, they build everything. In America, we build for cars, and we let our trains go to shit. Like, that is the worst. Like, I can't, it is so frustrating to fly into a city and there not be a subway connection. Like, it makes no sense to me. Like, why would you have a city, an airport, that isn't connected to the downtown by a subway? Like, it's the exception here in America where that is the case. In China, it would be insane to not have that. You know, even if there isn't a subway line connecting to the airport, it's planned. Like, they're building it. So that's one thing. Elisa's parents live in Sedona, Arizona, and we were just there. And, you know, we went to the city. You know, they live kind of on the outskirts. We went to the city, the core, the center, to go shopping. We spent 3 hours, and we had to drive from store to store to store. It's crazy. Like, it's insane. It's so incredibly inefficient. And they have these super wide roads with these wide medians. And as we're driving, the only thing I can think of, why isn't there like a streetcar that runs here? why are they building these stores set back hundreds of feet from the street? Why aren't they on the street and the parking behind them? Like why isn't it walkable? It doesn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. You know, where I live is not perfect, but there is a sense that there are lots of people and you need to have ways for them to be able to move around multiple different types of transportation. But in America, there's no consideration for that. It's get a car or you're screwed. And that bothers me. Also, I hate carrying cash. Haven't had to carry cash in China for like 3 years. I don't even bring my wallet with me anymore because everything's on my phone. And America, in some ways, is like stepping backwards in time a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, those are things that I can kind of easily grouse about. But they're also kind of the things that affect you most day to day. Like, you live your life very differently when you're overseas, just because of where you're living and the different systems that they have to make the world go around. And when you come back, you can't do that. It feels like, why can't I do the thing that I want to do? You know?
Yeah, you're constrained.
Yeah.
You said moving back in time. That's, you know, as someone who still lives here, that's, it's dismaying.
Insulting.
it's disturbing.
Yeah.
One thing I'm also interested in is I know that you are an avid follower of the news, including U.S. news and world news. What would you say is the difference between, I guess, the picture that's painted within the U.S. media of what's going on globally versus, you know, the reality as you see it from overseas, you know, the filter through which we receive our news versus what you're seeing and hearing in China?
It's very U.S.-centric, which makes sense because if you're in the U.S., you see the world through the lens of being in the U.S. Like, that makes a certain amount of sense. The problem is that also leaves out a lot of truth, a lot of fact. I can speak to, like, I have the most knowledge about things that are happening in China versus what American media says about what's happening in China. The easiest way to imagine that is to say, imagine you're living in New York City and your only source of news about what's happening in New York is some local newspaper, some neighborhood newspaper in a tiny corner of Brooklyn. I mean, that's literally what's happening in China. All the Western media are based in the major cities, you know, Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, maybe Hong Kong as well, and they're not even the mainland. And they have to fan out into the rest of the city and the rest of the country to get the news. I mean, first of all, there's not a lot of them. Second of all, they're not based in a lot of those cities, so they can't develop contacts. They don't get to know the people on the ground. So their perspective on the whole country is super narrow. Even as someone who lives there, I, from my news about China, because I don't speak Chinese, my news about China is dependent on not only the foreign journalists who are reporting for Americans, but also the local media that's translated to English. And I do get local news that isn't sent out. Like, I read stuff about stuff that's going on in China that Western media doesn't report on. But even that is limited. So, and I understand that. But I do know enough Chinese to get an idea of what's on their news, but it's also state controlled. I guess I would just say the idea, the way that America sees the world, I don't want, it's difficult because you don't want to, a lot of it gets into kind of the politics. The political narrative will determine the media narrative. So the stories that you read are they are naturally written in a way that fits into the political narrative, that, you know, the political narrative is the foundation and everything else has to feed into that. So it's kind of hard to say what is the U.S., you know, what is the difference between the U.S. perspective and what's the real thing without talking about the political context in America. And that gets into a lot of crazy stuff. But
we don't have time for today.
Yeah. But I will say this. America, and this is true in every country as well, although Europeans are a little more used to looking at their neighbors. But I will say any country you're in, you're going to not be able to get the full scope because you are just not there. You know, that's
right,
not
seeing it through only that.
Yeah.
That lens.
I would say in that sense, people who live overseas, expats, migrants, whatever, I would say they naturally have the ability to see the different perspectives because they've lived in them.
Right.
But I don't think that gives us anything special. That's just we, like, if you're sitting over there and I'm sitting right here, we're seeing things from both angles. And if I go over there, I will have then seen it from both angles. It doesn't mean I know more. It just means I've seen it from both sides. You know?
You have a different perspective.
Yeah.
So what are the things about living in China that you dislike, that you would change if you could?
The spitting. Yeah. Well, okay. So I actually was at a panel discussion at the U.S. Embassy about foreigners' experience living overseas, specifically in China. And one of the people in the audience actually asked, what are the things about China that you think need to be fixed? What are our problems as foreigners? He kind of wanted the perspective. As foreigners, what can you tell us about things we need to improve? Mm-hmm. And I told him straight out, I said, you don't need me to tell you what's wrong. You know what's wrong. It's not my job to tell you what's wrong. And I really believe that. Like, it's any complaint.
But personally, what would you change?
I really wouldn't change anything. You know, I've actually, in my earliest days living over here, when I talked to people back home, I don't remember if we ever had this conversation. We probably didn't. But I remember telling people about the way things worked in China and telling them the good things that China has done. Like, they've lifted 600 million people out of abject poverty. They've built cities. They've built, you know, Beijing alone has built an entire New York subway system since I lived there. And they're literally building another one. Like, they do amazing things. And then someone will come back and say, oh, are they better? Like, you think they do things better than us? And I said, no, I think we're better because I'm an American. But what pisses me off is that we don't do it at all. You know, we let them do it and them be the best at it, but we could be better. Like, what is done in China is good for China. You know, they like it, at least to a, you know, whatever extent they can. You can like it in an autocratic society, but what they have works for them. It's not my place to say it should change or it should be better, because my context, I wouldn't want it. I wouldn't want it for me. I like the American system. It's what I grew up with. But I also get frustrated to see that if people in this system can do it, why can't we do it better in our system that is better? You know, the whole Make America Great thing. Well, if we're so awesome, why are we letting them do the things and we don't do them?
Right.
You know?
Here's a question I've always wanted to ask. What is really the difference between Alibaba and Amazon?
Everything. Well, you're asking a really big question, because it's not just about those companies. It's about the nature of Chinese tech versus Western tech. So Alibaba is often called the Amazon of China, which is a misnomer because there's a lot more behind it. There are several, quote, Amazons of China. One is JD.com. There's some other ones. But what you're really talking about is an tech ecosystem that is derived from a culture that interfaces with technology in a fundamentally different way than we do in the West. So in the West, we had laptops, we had desktops, then we had, you know, PCs, laptops, and we kind of gradually moved our way into smartphones. So we interfaced with the internet and information in a certain way. In China, they never went through the desktop and laptop phase. They immediately started with smartphones. So right away, you interface with technology. You think about it in a different way. Plus, the cultural relationships are different. You want to have a relationship with people that you do transactions with. So social media is a way for you to connect with people and establish a relationship, right? The way streaming is huge in China. It's not huge in America. Why? Because streaming provides a forum for people to build relationships. They have a huge migrant population internally. So imagine you're from, you know, West Bumfuck, Iowa, and you move to New York, right? You move to New York, you don't know anybody, right? But there are other people around there who are just as lonely as you. You know, you're working in some factory 18-hour days. How are you going to feel like you have relationships? Well, you can go online, right? And you can watch people online perform. You can have, you know, there's chat rooms, and you can establish relationships with people. So just the way that people interface with technology, married with the way the culture is and interpersonal relationships are, is just so different from America that the technology companies have just created products that are different than what's in the West. So saying what's the difference between Amazon and Alibaba is like asking, how is the internet in China different from how the internet is in America? And it's very complex, and the media in America won't really describe that very well, which is a little frustrating.
Hence my question.
Yes, I'm glad you did. And I will take that as a note to something I have to talk about in the future. Well, we've been going for about 30 minutes. I'm happy to go longer if you have some more questions, but I know you wanted to go soon.
I guess I'll end with this question. Who is the most fascinating individual you have met so far in your time in China, apart from dear Elisa, your wife?
My wife. Thank you for that qualification. Wow, most interesting person. You know, there are so many experiences I've had, and I've talked about this with some people I've spoken with on the podcast, and I've spoken about it with Elisa. Like, you're one of my best friends ever, and there are things that I can describe to you, like just experiences I've had, people I've met, and I can't communicate. Like, there's always going to be something missing from that story that I tell you. Like, I mentioned flippantly to you earlier today about the time I met the governor of Qinghai province, you know, at this event. I don't know how, like, there was a whole experience that went around with that, and the people I met there, some of them I'm still in contact with. And it was such a formative kind of thing, because I learned a lot about Chinese culture. I learned a lot about business culture. I learned a lot about politics and the idea of face. And I mean, I could tell. They literally organized a huge festival for our little group of fake foreign business people. I mean, it was in a soccer stadium, and it was broadcast on state TV. It was unbelievable. This huge 3-hour gala for us. And, you know, I can't accurately describe how surreal that was. And that is something that, and I know you asked about who's the most fascinating person. What I'm trying to say is the people I've met that are fascinating, maybe I met for one night. You know what I mean? And it's difficult. And this is kind of what's frustrating and a little heartbreaking for me, is because when I come back here and I want to tell you everything and share everything with you, and I don't know how.
It's too much to capture.
Yes, it's too much. Like, I don't have the words, and because I don't just want to communicate the thing that happened. I want to communicate all that it meant to me and how it changed me. And I don't know how to do that. And even if I did, I don't know if you would be able to relate to it. And
but I feel like this comes back to the beginning for me of where we started when I asked you, how would you describe Boston to people in China who have never been there? You can't without telling stories.
Right.
Is, I guess, what you're saying. So that's the lesson, you know, is you take with you these experiences and the stories and the impressions and perceptions you take from a meeting, even if it's one night or 100 meetings, and you can only convey it to someone else in those stories.
I hope you let me keep telling you stories.
Yeah, forever. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. It was fun.
Well, thanks for doing it. Love you.
Love you.
Well, that's it. Episode 1 of Season 2 is in the can. I hope you enjoyed that one. There's lots more great conversations coming up. As I said, I'm really being challenged this season with these new conversations, and I'm really, really excited for you to be listening along. We're going to learn a lot. Please remember to reach out with any feedback, any questions you have, any interview suggestions, or topics you just want to make sure I cover. You can reach me at mike.shaw@migrationmedia.net, and I'm on Twitter at ZAX2000. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.